In a general way, the background, you were born in about 1916 in Greenville. You went to Clemson in the mid-30s. You went to the Greenville Papers from 37 to 42. Is that right?
Well, I went in 41. In the fall of 41, I went up to Harvard as a Nieman Fellow.
Went to the Nieman Fellowship.
I never came back to the Greenville Papers.
Okay. Then you were in the service.
That's right.
Were you in the Army or the Marines?
Army. I went in. I had a reserve commission out of Clemson, a second lieutenant of infantry. And so after Pearl Harbor, I was at Cambridge as a Nieman Fellow. And shortly thereafter, I got called up.
Uh-huh.
And I left Cambridge in, I guess, about February.
So you really went from the Nieman program straight into active duty.
Straight down to Fort Benning, where they took the retread reserve officers. We took the same basic, the same thing, officers training corps.
Yeah.
And then I went from Benning out to Austin, Texas, to the 95th Infantry Division, which was just being formed out of Kadri. And I stayed with the 95th Infantry Division until the end of the war in Europe, from beginning to end. And we were in the 3rd Army, we were in Patton's Army. And,
and you were in a lot of combat and all that.
Yeah, I had about 10, 11 months of it.
Yeah.
And we had one time, we were 50% casualties, infantry regiments.
Jeez.
So I saw a lot of that. And then at the end of, after VE Day, I suddenly got ordered back to the Pentagon. By that time, I was lieutenant colonel, and I was the assistant operations officer of the division. And I got ordered back to the operations division in the Pentagon, and I stayed there between VE and VJ Day. And as soon as I could get out after VJ Day, I went to Charlotte, where I became the editor of the Charlotte News.
Right, and you stayed there for 2 years, till 45 to 47.
Right.
And then at the Gazette from 47 till 57?
No, until
59. Okay.
Really 60, I guess.
All right.
The fall of 59, I suppose.
Okay. That's the general outline. And my interest is going to stop in May 54. That's where my book is going to stop. But going back into this period then, I wanted to ask you just in a general way to talk about a few people who were colleagues of yours in the press in that time. One of them was Virginius Dabney.
Yes. V. Dabney, I was devoted to him, and I met V, I guess after I went to Charlotte. I then started going to the American Society of Newspaper Editors annual meeting, and I met V there. And V was very, he was a lovely, kind fellow. And this is an interesting byline on this. Old Douglas Southall Freeman retired. This must have been in 47. And so they were looking for an editor, editorial page editor, for the News Leader in Richmond. V, of course, was on the morning paper, Times-Dispatch. So V suggested me, and I went up to Richmond to be interviewed by Tenant Bryant, who was the owner of the publisher. And I was taken to lunch, and they started questioning me, and a guy named Jack Wise, who was a general manager.
Right.
They started to question me about general policy, and after about the fourth question, I knew damn well this was a case of utter incompatibility that I never could conceivably. So I went back home, and Jack Kilpatrick is the one they hired instead of me.
Right.
And he became the father of interposition and so forth.
Yeah.
But that's the connection, and then I'd see V after that, and I had a great sympathy for V, and I wrote about this in Hearts and Minds, you'll see in there, where V was just muzzled.
Yeah.
That Kilpatrick was doing all this outrageous business, which outraged V.
Yeah.
And he said in his own memoir, have you read that?
Yeah.
Across the Years or whatever, he says then that he had to stay silent.
Yeah.
And he couldn't criticize Jack.
Yeah.
V was, I characterized him in Hearts and Minds as saying that he was as liberal as you could get in that day. He would not accept the end of segregation, but within the pattern, he was probably in advance of everybody else. In the war years, for example, he was supporting FEPC, he was supporting fair employment.
Right.
He came out for ending segregation on public transportation way back there.
Yeah, 42.
Damn few other people in the South were even bringing that subject up.
Yeah.
But V would stop short, and if you This goes to his experience with the Southern Regional Council, where he wouldn't go along, and it finally got to be a real cleavage between Mays and some of the black, and who's about Dillard?
Yeah.
The president of Dillard, that was his name.
Albert Dean.
Yeah, and that was a real showdown, real confrontation.
Yeah.
V would not go the whole way.
Yeah.
He wouldn't go from the end of segregation. But within that limit, it seems to me that he wrote this book called Liberalism in the South.
32.
Yeah, which is interesting to see what was considered to be a Southern liberal. Yeah,
hardly mentions race.
Hardly mentions it. He just accepted that as a given. That's really it. And it's understandable because it was not an issue. There was no pressure
that's
on the black side.
That time it wasn't.
And damn little on the outside, but the North, I mean, you'd have got a little pro forma business in Congress, but nobody expected it to pass.
Yeah. I don't want to get off on this and linger on it, but I think I would be inclined to say that after about 38, the Supreme Court had ruled in the Missouri case, and the Southern Conference for Human Welfare had come along, and several books had come out in that period.
That connection, the Southern Conference took up the poll tax deal and made a big thing out of that. And I remember my reaction to that, I don't remember the time, but after I got to Charlotte, this was still an issue.
Yeah.
And I would ridicule the whole damn poll tax movement, saying, what the hell is it, but what they really got is the white primary. I mean, you don't need the poll tax. No black can vote, but poll tax disfranchises the poor whites. But in South Carolina, it wasn't enough money to make any difference. You could have repealed the poll tax in South Carolina, wouldn't have changed the damn thing.
Yeah, still
had a totally white primary. They did it throughout the South.
Right.
That didn't yield until the Texas case, the Supreme Court just knocked out the white primary, and then blacks were really enfranchised. So the poll tax was a symbolic irrelevance. It's kind of like the death penalty.
Yeah.
You know? It didn't have a hell of a lot to do with the reality. It was as important as a symbol. And so that was what I remember about that reaction. The other thing that, of course, I said in Charlotte that I could get establishment support for any plea for justice, including even the vote for blacks. If it didn't, it stopped short of what they call the social question. That meant if it stopped short of schools. But otherwise, I could crusade for opening up the polls to blacks, for equalizing teachers' pay, and all that kind of thing.
With places where physical intermingling became an issue.
That was the one. And when the school cases were before the court, I then began, and I knew how it was going to come out because I did that study.
Yeah.
That again was before the Brown decision may come into your
ken,
the Negro in the schools.
Yeah, that I see that study as being sort of at the end of my book.
Right.
It came out the day the Brown
decision. The concluding paragraph in it was, of course, I was under wraps in writing that because it was really a summary of what these scholars had done, and of course they were so being so objective, they were falling over backwards, and everybody was sympathetic to the end of it. And I said what I then believed, that this was not going to make any great change in attitudes of itself, but it would redefine the goal that the people had to seek, that the Supreme Court knocked out separate schools.
Did you, in point of fact, believe at that time that it would, in fact, profoundly affect attitudes?
I was convinced there was no other way. If they ever faced it, they could weasel around, but it seemed to me they'd gotten past that separate but equal was so blatantly on the end that you couldn't. We thought, well, it possible that they might declare, make a bill which would require on the federal edict the equalization, which no state could afford. There was a goddamn unequal.
It was almost as much
of a blow. And in some ways, it might have been better if they'd done that, if they had actually left the schools segregated and improved, genuinely improved, and brought the black schools up to standard. Then the integration could have begun on a more equal basis. But
they didn't have the resources to pay for that.
The white schools
were so damn poor.
They were so poor, and furthermore, you knew damn well when the Supreme Court left it to good faith. There wasn't any good faith. There never had been. I mean, they've been lying and fudging those goddamn figures for ever since they'd had a school system. And I don't know whether you remember, I don't know whether that was in Epitaph or not, but I wrote a brief for the governor of Florida to be filed in the second round.
Oh, you did?
When he argued for implementation. And I was retained by the governor of Georgia. Before Collins.
Miller Caldwell?
Maybe it was Collins. I'm not sure, but anyway, I had to deal with the Attorney General.
I believe it might have been Collins.
Very courtly fellow.
You took over in 55.
That's right. I went down there, and an assistant attorney general, the young man, dealt with me, and I wrote this long memorandum in which I suggested this is what they should put in the brief. I didn't include any of it. They went the other way. They had an absolute preposterous brief before the Supreme Court. But actually, this memorandum did get to Earl Warren, said he saw it, and he also said he'd seen Hearts and Minds. He told me that later. And that while they didn't, that didn't have much to do with Brown 1. It had a good deal to do with Brown 2. But that's why they put in the all deliberate speed. They wanted to make an uncompromising stand on principle, but avoid having the courts have to enforce it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, to that extent, it had some influence. Now, it's in Hearts and Minds.
Yeah.
In fact, I quote from this memorandum. You may be interested in taking a look at that, because this was at the time. Well, it was done in the interval. Brown 1 had come down, but that year before Brown 2 came down.
Yeah, right.
That was a quiet time. Uh-huh. Nothing much was happening.
Right. Some other people I wanted really just kind of identify. I'm not really quite sure where they fit. Tarleton Collier.
Tarleton Collier was an editor and writer for the Louisville papers.
Before that, he worked in Atlanta at some paper called the Atlanta Georgian.
That's right, which was a Hearst paper.
What the hell was that?
It was a Hearst paper. It was an afternoon paper, a very flashy Hearst-type paper.
Huh.
I don't know when it expired.
He was writing for that paper in 38, because he wrote
a
piece.
I think it ran up to the war.
He wrote a piece about the Southern Conference
body. And then he went to Louisville, didn't he? Mm-hmm.
To the Courier Journal, yeah. That's right.
I never knew him too well. I knew it.
Do you know where he was from?
I don't.
Okay.
Probably Georgia.
Yeah.
Guess would be.
And then a guy named Henry Lesesne, L-E-S-E-S-N-E.
Lesane. Yeah, that's the way they pronounce it.
Lesane.
Henry Lesane was at the Columbia State, was he, or the Columbia Record?
The stuff that I find is in the New York Herald Tribune.
Was he a correspondent or just a stringer? I think he was a stringer.
It didn't say, just long pieces in the New York Herald Tribune.
I think
Herald
he was a stringer, and I think Henry Lesane was one of the Columbia papers, I think, either the Record or the State. He must have been a stringer for the Herald Tribune.
I mean,
I remember him. I didn't know him too well.
Is he dead? You suppose?
I think when I was covering the legislature, he was around.
Be dead now? Older than you?
Probably. I'll inquire. Somebody might know him.
Ask when you go, would you? By some accident, it should have some really long, thoughtful pieces that he did.
Well, Lesane is one of those old sacred Charleston names. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those old Huguenot French names. Lesane's one of the leading FFSC family. So he was of the old blood, mm-hmm. and it's very much a low country Charleston name.
All right. Thomas Sancton, I mentioned earlier.
Tom Sancton may be still alive, and the way to find out about that is to call, you know Neil Davis?
Yeah.
Call Neil. John says he's been in the hospital, he must be out. He would know.
Okay.
He stayed in touch with Tom and sort of helped him dry out and looked after him.
And you said he was from New Orleans?
Yeah. He was from Louisiana, and he wound up back in New Orleans. He was married while we were Neiman fellows. He married, his wife was the daughter of the Chief Justice of Louisiana, I remember. Very pretty girl. And so Tom, I'm sure, grew up in Louisiana. I don't know whether it was New Orleans, but that's where he wound up.
Who else was in your Neiman class from the South besides Neil Davis?
Well, Neil Davis and Sancton and I, and there was a fellow named Henning Help, who was the editor of the Miami Harold.
Henning.
Helt, H-E-L-D-T. He's dead. He's been dead a long time. He was the first one of our contemporaries to die. I think we were the only Southerners. We were the designated provincials.
Yeah, right. Hodding Carter.
Hodding was a very close friend.
You were good friends for a long time.
Right.
You write in Hearts and Minds about the occasion in the summer and fall of 48 when you and he went on a barnstorming tour through the East to kind of debate.
Well, it wasn't just one appearance.
Was it just one?
Yeah, we were up there for a Forum of the Air. It was a town hall meeting. It was television was in its infancy then, but that was a big program on radio. And it was a debate on segregation. This was in 48.
One-shot deal.
One shot, and we had Walter White and a man named Ray Spriggle, who had put a black face on, was a Pittsburgh reporter. They were for desegregation, and Harding and I were defending the honor of the South.
Yeah.
All that. I have a transcript of that.
You do.
Would you like that?
Yeah, I'd like to listen to it.
Well, sure. I mean, it's printed.
Oh yeah, I definitely would like to read it.
In fact, I think I've got several. They put these things out on the paper and sent them around.
Definitely would like
it
to
was ABC, I guess, and Town Hall of the Air, it was called. It was done in Town Hall in New York, we had a big audience.
In 48.
Yeah. That's the first time I met Walter White. It was in the head of the NAACP.
Right.
And I told a story about the time they were putting the makeup on. They had to lighten up Harding and darken down Walter. He was pink-cheeked, blue-eyed.
Right. Yeah.
Harding was an interesting fellow, and he was kind of like McGill. He was very emotional. And he was... Harding was an interesting case. He was his approach was about like Faulkner's. He was for justice, and he knew this was coming, but he didn't want to see the black folks corrupted by the white folks. And he was very patrician, and came of an old, I think he came from Hammond, Louisiana. I think that's his hometown. As a matter of fact, he had a newspaper there before he went to Greenville.
That's right.
And Betty, his wife,
she's still living. I'm trying to
talk
with
her. Her mind said she's wonderful because she was smart. She really ran the business. I mean, Harding was like McGill. He was exotic. He was emotional.
Yeah,
was on the right side, but he would always do the right thing. And he, for example, when the boycott started against the Gazette, he was defending the Gazette from across the river. Although he didn't entirely agree with editorially with our position, the law and order position, but he was with when we were attacked by the Citizens Council, he was all out.
Yeah.
For it.
He was a very honorable man.
Very honorable and an interesting guy. And he was a very literate, you know, he wrote a hell of a lot of books.
Oh God, he wrote a lot,
He overwrote badly, but Harding III said about him once, he said they would refer to my father as a moderate. He said it was the most immoderate moderate I ever knew. And all. He was a great coxman, and he was a great drinking man. Yeah. And he, of course, he lost the sight of one eye, and he was old. He damn near went blind toward the end. The other eye was failing.
How did he lose? I mean,
well,
just
it was in the
deterioration.
It was in the service, and the war.
Oh,
wound.
It was an accident.
It wasn't a war wound, but he was on maneuvers somewhere down in Florida, and he ran into a palmetto, and punctured one eyeball, and that eye, they had to take that eye out, and it began to affect the other one, which frequently happens.
Yeah.
So he was totally blind in one eye.
Like Pitchfork Ben Tillman.
Yeah, that's right. He had a glass eye, actually.
Yeah.
And his eyesight was always worrying, and it was fading, and toward the end, he was damn near blind. I mean, he really needed to see at all, but he'd still travel, and he'd still drink a lot.
Yeah.
It doesn't make much difference if you blind anyway.
But
he was a great coxman and just a hell of a fellow. I mean, he was really sort of the Louisiana patrician type.
Yeah.
You know, the great hale hunting, fishing.
Well, he and McGill really fascinate me because I see both of them as being much more admirable after Brown than before.
Well, that's true. When they were, but they also had a reaction that I didn't have. I was much more detached, I guess. Maybe because of an upcountryman. Well, McGill was too. He grew up in the hills. But they had this emotional feeling about it, so they got defensive about the South. They knew it was wrong, and they'd say that, but by God, those people can't tell us what to do up there. And I kept saying, well, that hasn't got anything to do with it. Yeah. I mean, if this thing's going to be dealt with, it's going to have to be dealt with here.
They knew they knew the day of reckoning was coming.
Well, they knew it. They accepted it. They all did. But they just couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
And it didn't bother me. I didn't have that reaction.
Yeah.
McGill, as I once described him, he was a political fixer and he was a troubadour as well as everything else.
Yeah.
And McGill was a, well, he was defensive.
Yeah.
He really had this thing about some symbol of the South.
Well, was it somehow deep down inside of them essentially racial in the final analysis that really they could not imagine themselves making an accommodation of this magnitude?
No, I don't think so. I think that they could imagine. I think that wouldn't bother them at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been in the old Plata's, loved your butler.
Yeah,
whatever,
it was still going to be on their turn.
Yeah, in a sense, but I think more than anything else with them, it was this defensive attitude.
Yeah.
As them outsiders, goddamn, anybody going to tell us what to do?
God knows the outside gave them plenty to be pissed about.
Christ. The outside didn't give a damn.
That's right. See, the thing I see looking at it from my perspective is that through this time, through the late 30s and through the war years and all the way to Brown, there were some fairly courageous journalists, preachers, academics, people here and there. And by the time Brown came, they had fallen silent.
Well, that's
whereas McGill and Carter and a few other people who sort of were defensive through that time, they were so goddamn outraged by the absolute defiance of the law that they went out there and took the
life. I think that's true. And you did too. Well, I kept saying over and over again that the tragedy of this is the default of the goddamn establishment.
Yeah.
Quite cynical that you'd see in the Arts and Minds, that it's going to change because once they figure it's bad for business, they're going to come around, but not before that. You can't argue with them on morality, you can't argue with them on tradition, you can't argue with them on noblesse oblige.
Yeah.
The bastards are not, they're just going to sit there until the roof falls in, and then, of course, they're going to come around, and they'll come around just as far as they have to and no further. There was a brief time, it seems to me, when there was kind of a period of goodwill after they finally recognized that they had to do it.
Yeah.
And that began to diminish when the cost went up and when the blacks began. There's another aspect of this that I've thought about too, that I'll say in defense of both Harding and McGill. A lot of people said that this was one of the standard calumnies that was addressed to me and said, what these Southern people really couldn't stand is to have the blacks take over the movement, but they'd have been running it at their own convenience, and they resented the thing. I think that was totally untrue. I was delighted to see the blacks take over, and I think McGill was,
too. You think that McGill and Carter would have felt that same way?
I think they accepted this. I felt it was really the white man's burden. I mean, there was no way that a black in the South could protest.
Yeah.
He had to have somebody like me or McGill or V. Dabney speaking out for simple justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just delighted when they began to take it over. I'd been wanting to see this all along.
Yeah.
Delighted to be relieved of the burden.
Right.
And I think that was true of McGill. McGill, once he came around, he certainly accepted, and I think it's very significant that he died at a black man's home, when he had his heart attack.
Where was he?
There was some child who had done something of graduating from high school, and he and his wife, you should talk to her about this. They'd gone out to have dinner with this black family because McGill was so impressed by the child, and he was there when he had the heart attack.
I didn't know that.
And this is interesting. Now, McGill would do that, too.
He would
do it. I never thought that kind of thing was important, but it was to McGill.
It was to him. Yeah,
and he was to eat with black people.
Right. Yeah.
I told a story somewhere about being on Adlai Stevenson's plane with McGill, do you recall that?
I think I do recall that story,
That's a typical McGill story. I'd been with Stevens, this was in 52. McGill was traveling with Stevens. I'd been up in Springfield writing some speeches, and I went, got on the press plane to go on the Southern Swing. We started off with, well, I picked them up in St. Louis. We went to Oklahoma City, then New Orleans, then to Miami, and back to Nashville, where I'd written the Nashville speech. So when I joined up with them in St. Louis, McGill was there, and I was at the hotel where all the press was staying. And there were two black correspondents, New York correspondents from Amsterdam News, I guess. What the hell was that guy's name? Anyway, they had just gotten word that night that when they got to New Orleans, they were not going to be able to stay in the hotel with the rest of the press because the New Orleans was segregated,
yeah.
And we stayed at the Roosevelt Hotel. So that word had circulated, and these two guys were saying, well, we're going to make a goddamn issue of this. Mm-hmm. We'll get there tomorrow night. McGill was so upset about this, I went and told Harper Schlesinger, who was going to travel with the candidate, that this was trouble coming up and they better know about it.
Mm-hmm.
We got on the plane to go to Oklahoma City, and these two black men were sitting up front. So McGill and me, he took me along, and we went up to plead with them not to make the issue, which was going to hurt Stevens. And they were adamant. They said, no, but we can't stay in that hotel. We're going to have a press conference. We're going to blow the roof off. So McGill said, well, look, I can hear him now. He said, they were going to stay with, I guess they were going to stay with Dent. They were going to be put up in some place with black university president. McGill said, well, if you can't get in the hotel, how would it be if Ashmore and I came out and stayed with you out there? I said, well, they said, no, that wouldn't do it either. So we hit the ground in Oklahoma City, and by that time I realized that the shit was really going to hit the fan when we got to New Orleans. So McGill and I got off the plane, and I was trying to find a telephone. I thought I'll call George Chaplin, who was then the editor of the Item, and see if George can't do something to tell the goddamn hotel, just look the other way. I'm going to be two black men turning up with about 300 people. Nobody's ever know whether they stay in the hotel or not.
Yeah.
So I was trying to find a telephone. I lost McGill. I couldn't find him. I was looking all around for him, and we were waiting for the cars to go into Oklahoma City, and I couldn't see him. Finally, I saw him way over by the fence. And there were a bunch of Indian children who were on the other side of the cyclone fence and come out to see the candidate. McGill was over there talking to these little Indian children. He was just bemused by children. Well, I got him, and we got into Oklahoma City, and I got a telephone and called George Chaplin out of Item and said, Jesus Christ, George, I told him what was happening. I said, can't you talk to the guy that runs the damn Roosevelt Hotel and tell him that, you know, nobody's going to know whether they're in there or not? He said, oh, no, no. He said, that son of a bitch is the head of the state's rights movement down here, and all he needs is an excuse to make an issue out of it.
Yeah.
So they got down there. They called a press conference, and by that time it was about 9 o'clock at night, I guess, and we were all about to take off for a speech with Stevenson. Stevenson's press man took the rap and said he was totally responsible, of course, and they issued their statement, and we all went down to the French Quarter and got drunk, and I guess it was filed in the New York Times. It ran about a paragraph in a couple of New York papers. Otherwise, the whole thing was that. But McGill, this is typical of McGill. This is the kind of thing he was willing to do. He'd stick his own neck out. He said, yeah, I'll go out there and stay with you.
Yeah, well.
So it's hard to tell about
it. Yeah, yes. Everybody's complicated. I mean, shit, nothing's simple, you know. Some academics, Howard Odum, Frank Graham, and W.T. Couch were all together at the University of North Carolina. What I'm beginning to find out is that they did not like one another. They were very competitive. They worked behind one another's back.
Right. Odum, I got to know when I got to Charlotte. I hadn't known him before. And then when I was doing the Negro in the schools, by that time, Alex Hurd had succeeded Odum as the head of that institute, and so I saw a lot of them down there. Then because the University of North Carolina Press brought the book out, I guess Keitch was, I think he was still there. No,
he'd
gone to Chicago
by
that time. Couch had this reputation when I was at the Charlotte News of being somewhat of a liberal, but I found that the, most of the people down there at Chapel Hill didn't buy this.
Yeah.
And Calchat got into some kind of a hassle with Hutchins up at the, he was apparently a very difficult son of a bitch. Yeah, I must admit him.
But he's still alive.
Is he?
Yeah, but he's...
But this, he's apparently really one of these basically contentious people who makes an issue out of everything and what he disagrees with. Odom was interesting. Odom was very reluctant to endorse desegregation because he wrote that, well, he wrote the thing originally for Life. It became a book. It talked about the secret toll of the Southern people attitude.
Yeah.
But he came around, of course, and he was probably, it seems to me, in that period, probably the most influential academic in the region.
Right.
His preaching regionalism and all that kind of thing, which really didn't have a lot to do with race, but it put a more a broader view. It really attacked the old Southern myth.
Yeah,
you know, the aristocracy.
Yeah, he wanted to use it as the way to get eventual racial change.
He kept bringing out charts and graphs to prove that there was a middle class farm element in the South that was comparable to that in New England. Well, they might have had one or two slaves, but these were the people that really created the New South. And it weren't the planters, it mattered the too damn few that were. These were not people in the plantation economy. They were in the self-subsistence.
Right.
He made a great point out of this. So he certainly was one of the, I think, the tremendously influential. He was as influential as any academic. I can't remember, think of any other academic that had really much influence.
Yeah.
In this area.
Yeah.
Frank Graham did, in a funny kind of way, with Frank with this wonderful, you know, sort of this country preacher manner, and he was 100% for academic freedom, and he could fight off these goddamn Bourbons in North Carolina.
He managed somehow to really hold his own.
He was responsible for the University of North Carolina being what it is.
Well, would it be safe to say what it was? Because one of the points that I think needs to be made is that if you measure from 50 on, when he's gone, it has never been what it was.
Oh, I think that's true. I think that he's...
Certainly not as far as these social issues.
It probably would have to be said, I'm not as sure about the history, but I think it probably had a pretty good reputation before Frank came along. But he protected it during the period when it was really being attacked.
Yeah.
All kinds of the McCarthy business. And old Frank was out there 100%, and he could go down and with an old shoe manner, and he could tell the country people that, you know, we've got to be freed. I think, I'm sure it's gone downhill. I'm not that familiar with it.
Do you think there was any university in the South that was in any remote sense like that?
Not at all. It was the only university in the South, aside from the racial thing, that you could really call distinguished.
Yeah.
I mean, it had a faculty. It had a very distinguished faculty. And it had real influence.
Yeah.
It had influence in North Carolina. And they attracted the best Southerners, that were in the teaching business.
Right.
No, the University of Virginia was a goddamn gentleman's finishing school. Private universities, Tulane and Vanderbilt,
Emory.
And Duke, Emory were nothing in those days. And they didn't have any influence whatever on the segregation.
And then if you take the sort of the flagship state universities like Arkansas, Alabama, Georgia, they were under the thumb of all these political demagogues.
And South Carolina, for God's sake, Clemson was, you know, God knows it was hardly a distinguished school. I went to school there, but it had the great good fortune of having old John C. Calhoun's son-in-law, Clemson, left the plantation to the state. And his will provided, which the state accepted, that half the trustees were life trustees.
Mm-hmm.
The other half were elected by the legislature. So they had these independent trustees on there who served till they died and named their successors,
mm-hmm.
still do.
Yeah.
And I think it gave them a degree of independence that the poor University of South Carolina next door to the State House didn't have. I mean, they were just leaned on.
Right. But even so, it didn't translate into any kind of enlightened social perspective like Chapel Hill had.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, Clemson, that wasn't its business. It was a technical school. It was like Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
It was turning out engineers.
Yeah. And if we took the time to look, we could probably identify some lawyers and some preachers and some other professional people who were progressive Southern enlightened folks of that time who at least would give lip service.
Well, for example, when the Fund for the Advancement of Education put together the Ashmore Project, we assembled 40 scholars off of Southern campuses, and every one of those accepted the fact that change was coming.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't out crusading, but I mean, they were economists and mm-hmm. educationists and whatever, and they basically, I'd say, they all accepted the fact that we'd be better off if we got rid of the dual school system.
Wasn't exactly a litmus test for them,
they recognized
you couldn't have gotten their cooperation unless they had that.
Well, in the first place, the fund went to every damn university in the private and public in the South before we assembled this thing and offered them a blank check. Said, look, all we want you to do is use your resources to go out and find out what's the case.
House this and let your name be associated with it.
And not a damn university president would touch it with a 10-foot pole. Including Chapel Hill. They went to all of them. Emory, I'm sure they went to Emory. Finally, they said, well, in the meantime, they found that these people were around who wanted to do it as individuals.
Uh-huh.
And so then they asked me to head it because they couldn't get an educator to touch the goddamn subject.
Yeah.
Think that's a telling
measure. It's a very telling, God, it is. I think it's
but on every campus, I think even the small ones, there was a few distinguished little schools, to some extent, it's like Davidson and like Hendricks in Arkansas, which were religious-oriented, and they had enough independence, and they had a few good people.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a hell of a lot, but they had a few good people. And they protected them. They really believed in academic freedom, so you'd find some people there even speaking out on this that weren't run out of town.
Yeah.
But that's the only place you'd find them. And a state university,
just
I don't
forget
think you'd find
it
at all.
And yet, you know, at that Southern Conference, Auburn University and the University of Alabama proudly announced that they had delegations of 25 people there.
You could do that because
it's exactly
race
right.
wasn't an issue.
Exactly right. And
it was just justice,
exactly
poverty,
right.
And
a little while later on, they
right.
wouldn't
when
have dared.
When it became an issue, everybody ran like hell.
Let's talk about some blacks for a minute. There's a fascinating book that came out in 1944 called What the Negro Wants, published at Chapel Hill, edited by Rayford Logan. Remember that name?
I remember.
Rayford Logan was an academic. It had 13 essays in it by black Southerners. No, not just Southerners. They were from all over the country. It was, the book was invited by W.T. Couch. He asked for this book. And when he saw the manuscript, he told Rayford Logan there was no way he could publish it because it was way too radical. And Rayford Logan said, if you don't publish it, I'm going to sue you. And so Couch thought this over and said, all right, I'll publish it, but I'm going to write a preface. I'm going to write an introductory piece.
Disavowing it.
And that's exactly what he did. And it's an extremely important book because I wish the hell I could find where
I don't remember it at all.
Dealt with it in
really
here.
I don't think I've ever heard of it.
A very important book because it it not only has Couch's position, which does not stand up well in the face of history, but it has also these 13 writers' positions, and they ranged, they were identified as being a diverse group from radical to
you don't have their names.
That's what I'm looking for. I've got all their names, and I wanted to ask you if you knew some of these people, because
I'd almost bet you I wouldn't recognize a single name.
No, you're going to know some of them. some of them were identified as radicals, and some were identified as moderates, and some were identified as conservatives. But they all came down the same damn way. I mean, they all said the evil here is segregation. And if we don't face up to that evil, then we're never going to be able to solve this other problem.
Well, the reason I say that is I have been struck by the fact that I knew so few native black leaders as such, even the academics. I knew a few university, I knew Charles Johnson, for example, and I knew Dillard, Dent down at Dillard, and I knew Thurgood Marshall, and I knew Walter White, but if you think about a black college professor, there was no occasion where I'd even see one, even as a sympathetic editor.
Right.
These people were under the table. I mean,
okay, it's going to be interesting then to read this list to you. These are the 13 people: Rayford Logan, W.B. Du Bois, of course, one of them.
Right.
Leslie Pinckney Hill.
Hill?
H-I-L-L. I believe he was an academic, but I'm not sure. Charles W. Wesley was a newspaperman from Houston. Roy Wilkins.
Well,
A. Philip Randolph. Willard S. Townsend was a head of the Red Cap quarters.
Right, I don't remember him.
Doxie Wilkerson.
Name's vaguely familiar, but I didn't know him.
Gordon Hancock. Well, Gordon Hancock was from Norfolk. He turned out to be a fairly significant person. Mary McLeod Bethune.
Well, yeah, I knew, because she was the one visible black in the New Deal.
Right. Frederick D. Patterson.
Yeah, Fred Patterson became a president of one of the colleges.
Tuskegee.
Tuskegee.
Yeah. George Schuyler.
Yeah, he was a Pittsburgh Courier columnist.
Langston Hughes.
Langston Hughes.
Sterling Brown.
Sterling Brown, who was he?
He was a novelist.
I didn't know any of those personally except Walter White and Du Bois, and I didn't know Du Bois personally. I met him once. But I was very familiar with them. They were national names.
Yeah.
They were not black. Southerners.
Well, they published this book, and I think of it as a sort of a benchmark book.
Well,
because
it sure is. It's also interesting the fact that college wouldn't publish it.
And he just said, I can't do this.
What they were saying, and this is significant, I would say back in the days when I was the editor at Charlotte, I would say to everybody, look, there's no black any longer who's going to support segregation. Now, you can deal with them on lesser questions, but you can't expect any of these people, if they're worth a damn, to take a public position. And this is what happened inside the Southern Regional Council. They kept trying to straddle the damn thing, and finally the blacks wouldn't take it.
Right.
Even Charles Johnson, who was the most compromising, he said, no, there's no way.
Right. It took 7 years.
Separate but equal is not acceptable to the blacks. I use the line in the epitaph and use it over and over again, and what I recognized and kept trying to say, for the white establishment, you've got to accept the fact that what we're up against is a situation in which segregation is not acceptable to the blacks, and desegregation is not acceptable to the whites. Now, that's practically where we are. What the hell are we going to deal with this? But you keep talking about, God, that even in Little Rock, they'd strike up some kind of a damn Uncle Tom.
Yeah, right.
They wanted
to create this sort of mythology
that there were
plenty of black people who were perfectly happy with the way things
and
were.
And a lot of them wouldn't speak out, but you knew damn well, if you went in, and how could anybody expect them to accept segregation?
Right.
I said nobody in his right mind ever accepted segregation willingly.
Yeah.
So it was accepted before that because they couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah. Charles Johnson and Benny Mays and Albert Dent and a handful of those people.
Yeah.
Look now in the sort of with the hindsight of history like fairly prophetic figures.
Right. Johnson's the only one I knew. I knew him fairly well. I was at a number of meetings with him. Once I was on a platform with him at an National Urban League convention in Kansas City, I remember. And I was very fond of him. He was kind of an elder statesman, an old man, and sort of mellow, but he kept saying, I'm not concerned about mixing the races. I'm just trying to get justice.
Yeah.
That's what I'm. Yeah. I don't care whether the races mix or not. That's yeah. That's incidental. He was really the elder statesman. He was a pretty good scholar.
Yeah.
And he had written several books.
Yeah.
He was, I'd say, for a period there, I think he was a key figure, actually, in putting the Southern Regional Council together.
He absolutely was. As a matter of fact, there was a little bit of intrigue that went with the that whole thing, that Durham meeting where the blacks...
Yeah, sure. And then this old woman down here was the one who set the whole thing
up. Yeah, Jesse Daniel Ames. She set it up, and I think she was trying to cut Odom off.
Well,
because
she
saw Odom taking it, you know, in a different direction. But anyway, Charles Johnson wrote that document, the Durham statement.
And it tried to make room without accepting segregation, and make room for everybody.
Right.
And McGill was wavering back and forth around that time.
Yeah.
I don't know what the...
I
wasn't involved in any of that. That came along, I guess I was still in the Army when that
was... Just in 44, were. Yeah. And it's curious, McGill was instrumental in that meeting,
right,
and in the subsequent meeting in Atlanta, and
right,
the meeting in Richmond, but then he disappeared.
That's
and never
right.
darkened the door of
That's
SRC.
Right, I know it.
What do you think that was about?
Well, apparently what happened was that I guess B. Dabney was in the head of the Southern Regional Council, chairman.
No, they asked him to be, and he never would do it. Dabney never would
do it. Fleming would know in detail about this, but my impression is that this Jesse Daniel Ames woman saw what was happening, and so she promoted Johnson and these people to have an all-black meeting,
right,
and come out with a relatively moderate program.
Right.
And then she wanted to put them together with the, well, I guess it was the old interracial commission
before
the Southern
Right.